Reading with your kids.
Hola, ni hao, konnichiwa, assalamu alaikum, shalom, mahaba, ciao, bonjour, namaste. Jumbo! Bienvenidos! Welcome, welcome, welcome. My name is Jed Lee, and this is Reading With Your Kids. We are beaming out to the world from Reedville, the gem of Southwest Boston, and we are so thrilled that you are joining us. At Reading With Your Kids, our mission is simple but powerful, to bring families together through the shared magic of books and stories. In every episode, we sit down with fascinating folks who are creating books that open hearts and spark imaginations. Do you want to help us grow this mission? Then please tell all of your family and friends, your kids' teachers, even the crossing guard, that they can hear us on the WREB AM-FM 24/7 radio network. And they can find us on the iHeartRadio app, on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Amazon Music, Good Pods, Podcast Addict, Audible, Player FM, Amazon Music. Wherever you find your favorite shows, you can find Reading With Your Kids. We have a wonderful show lined up for you today. First up, Dr. Brad Marshall is here to celebrate his brand new middle grade book. It's called Do Not Disturb. Later in the show, we meet Ashley Key, who is celebrating Dash and the Lights in the Sky. And we'll also have a listen back to a conversation we had with famed oceanographer Dr. Sylvia Earle. Hey, I want to let you know that this episode of Reading With Your Kids is brought to you by Chicken Coop Chaos by Nancy Tavares. Are you ready for some barnyard fun your kids will absolutely adore? Then you've got to check out Nancy Tavares' delightful books, Chicken Coop Chaos and Chicken Coop Chaos Christmas. In the original Chicken Coop Chaos, we meet Pearl, a hen who loves peace, order, and a tidy little hen house. But when Wendell the Rooster barges in and decides he's not leaving, Pearl has to hatch a clever plan to take back her space. And let's just say things get hilariously chaotic. And just in time for the holidays, Chicken Coop Chaos Christmas brings even more laughs, heart, and festive feathered fun. These books are perfect for young readers, classrooms, and family read-aloud time. So flap on over to your favorite bookstore or online retailer and grab your copies of Chicken Coop Chaos and Chicken Coop Chaos Christmas today. Your kids will be clucking with joy. Get ready, adventure fans. Toby Baxter is back. And I Heart River Home, the fourth thrilling book in the Adventures of Toby Baxter series, written by Tim Wright. 13-year-old Toby dives into his most unexpected quest yet. He's battling trolls, navigating the sandpit of love, and getting stuck with an L-O-V-E compass. But when the girl of his dreams, Rainy, is kidnapped, Toby must summon more courage than ever before. All four books in the Adventures of Toby Baxter series have been honored as Reading With Your Kids certified great reads, each packed with fast-paced action, humor, and heart. So grab your copy of I Heart River Home today and join Toby on an unforgettable journey through River Home, where every page is an adventure. Join us right now from right outside of Sydney in the beautiful nation of Australia. He's coming to us from tomorrow. Our guest is here today to celebrate his new middle grade novel. It's called Do Not Disturb. Please welcome to the show, Dr. Brad Marshall. Dr. Brad, how are you?
I'm doing well, Jed. Thanks very much for having me.
Yeah, you know, I said your new middle grade novel. I know the book was released in Australia with a different title, How to Say No to Your Phone. How long has the book been out into the world?
Oh, geez, you're testing me here, Jed. I think it's been out in the world for about a year. It started off through a publishing house in London called Magic Cat, and then it reached maybe, about a dozen countries before, of course, then it was released in the US very recently. And then I've just got in my hot hands a copy in Chinese Mandarin, so I understand it is reaching China now as well, which is fantastic.
So, obviously, phones are a problem. They're amazing. They're wonderful, but they're a problem. How much of our kids' time do phones capture in a day. I don't know if that was a sentence that you'd understand. I think I forgot how to speak English. But just they just demand our attention. And I'm imagining that kids have a much harder time saying no. What define the problem that phones are presenting to kids, please.
Yeah, of course. And so I guess when I talk about this, I don't just come from an author background. I am a psychologist at the Screens and Gaming Disorder Clinic in Sydney, which is sort of an international clinic. I see people from all around the world. But also I am a researcher and adjunct fellow at Macquarie University. So I've been researching into this. And the research that I've done was presented in Australia to our parliament last year as part of the testimony for banning social media for under 16s, which comes out in December. So just a bit of context there from where I'm coming from. The issue really that is presented is the amount of time that our young people are on their phone. Now, you could argue that as adults, we have a similar problem. I'm not here to judge people that are adults that are on their phones too much or on technology too much. Ultimately, my passion is around children and teenagers. And the reason is they have a developing brain.
Right.
And so the impacts are far greater. And that's what the research tells us, is that when we spend too much time on our phone or screens in general, and to give a bit of context here, the numbers are different depending on which studies you look at. Some studies look at just phones, others look at all screens, some look at, you know, school time, out of school time. So it's a bit muddled. But at Macquarie University, we did a recent study on Australian kids, which is grade 4 through grade 8, which is very much middle school, I think, for you guys, isn't it? Yeah. And what we found is that the average child was on screens about 9.5 hours a day, recreationally. Now, that's what they told us, Jed. That wasn't some version that we asked parents or teachers or anything like that. That is a self-report tool. Now, a good portion of that would be on their phone, but we didn't extrapolate exactly how much is on a phone versus an iPad versus a console, etc. But whenever you spend that amount of time on a screen, there are impacts neurologically and developmentally on a child and young people. So that's really what, I guess, if we frame what the problem is, that is my concern.
Yeah. It boggles my mind that you are a specialist in screen and gaming disorders. The idea that there are screen and gaming disorders, it's mind exploding. And I understand it, and I certainly have seen it in kids, but it's like it seems like we're our own worst enemy sometimes.
Do you know, Jed, that boggles my mind too. The fact that I, you know, conduct research in this field and work in this field, it still boggles my mind. So there's a bit of a story here. Back around 2008, I had a colleague, a child psychiatrist here in Sydney. I won't name him because it'll shame him. And he started asking, you know, oh, geez, you're seeing kids with, it was called internet addiction back then. Because, you know, 2008, smartphones were barely even a thing. Mm-hmm. And he said, oh, geez, you're going to specialize in that? I said, well, I don't know. Everyone just keeps sending me referrals, you know, GPs, schools, everyone kept sending me referrals. And it wasn't by design. I didn't get into this by design. The fact was, I was a youngish at the time, in my 20s, pediatric psychologist that was a male. And so therefore I had gamed myself, you know, old school games and phones, and I knew a thing or two in this area. But it wasn't really an area that anyone specialized in. And my colleague said to me, specializing in internet addiction, that's crazy. That won't go anywhere. And so we have a bit of a laugh now. And I did just last year when I was having lunch with him. Geez, it went nowhere, did it? Because it really did take off, but I had no idea. So I opened the Screens and Gaming Disorder Clinic in 2010. By about 2015, I essentially was not doing any other pediatric psychology work because I was so overwhelmed with those referrals. Mm-hmm. And then by about 2018, 2019, my first book, The Tech Diet for Your Child and Teen, was published. And so that's a parent focused book that is all evidence-based, strategies parents can actually use at home that we have empirically proven. So it really started taking off to the sense then of, in my clinic, I started seeing increasingly kids from all over Asia, the US, North America, Europe, and it is pretty wild now to think that I specialize in this area and I see people from all over the world. Mm-hmm. And as we see that generation of children get older, I'm getting more and more referrals from college kids, especially in the United States, that have gone off and are not managing their technology or their gaming very well and are literally failing college because they're getting wound up in 10, 12 hours a day of gaming or screens. So it is a bizarre thing for me as well, Jed, to think, how did I end up here? It was definitely not by design.
Yeah. Well, I don't think anybody could have predicted it. You know, and as I look back, I've joked here I think it's incredible. When I was a kid, I was making movies and we were doing these things we call tape radio, which in essence was a podcast. And we had a lot of fun. But I know that if I had this thing in my pocket that could make high quality videos that I could send around the world in a second, I would have done some really dumb stuff with it and got myself in trouble. But the idea that you could be addicted to it, that, you know, you'd have this disorder, that would never have come into my mind, but I certainly understand it.
Yeah. And the prevalence rates, which is just sort of a fancy term for the amount of people or kids that struggle with, gaming disorder, as we call it officially. I don't like that term, but anyway, it's the term that the WHO have given it. The prevalence rates are around 3% in most Western countries. So that's a fair amount of kids if you think about. In Australia here, we have 4 to 5 million kids in school. So you're talking about something like 100,000 kids. Now, for smartphone addiction, in our latest study, what we found is that 9.9% of kids had medium to high risk of smartphone addiction. That is 400,000 to 500,000 kids in this country alone. You can extrapolate those numbers to North America as well, and it would be an eye-watering number. So it's not a small number that are either at risk or have a smartphone addiction. And, you know, I think that most parents and teachers have seen that and will agree with that. I mean, how many of them argue with their children or their middle schooler or their teenager about getting off their phone? Now, again, we should acknowledge many of us are hypocritical because we're on our phones as well. But the fact is, kids and teenagers are going down that rabbit hole. And as you mentioned, I often reflect on and empathize with some of the kids that end up in my clinic, because I often say to parents and kids, if I was born in this modern technology, I 100% would have a problem with gaming.
Yeah.
If it was left unchecked. If you just take the idea that I could do all of the gaming that I used to do in the 90s, say like, you know, I don't know, Madden 92 or FIFA 92 or James Bond, GoldenEye, all of that gaming can now be done on a phone. And you can play most of these games in better quality and with people around the world on your phone. Yeah. And if I had access to that technology in the 90s, Jed, I would probably go down a rabbit hole.
Yeah, yeah. I remember, Dr. Brad, our kids got their phones early. I remember my wife was sitting at the dinner table. My son was in middle school and was looking at going to a private Catholic high school the next year. And he wasn't the most responsible at the moment. And, you know, I said to my wife, you know, next year, and he was depending on us to get him around. He wasn't taking, you know, being independent. And I said to at the dinner table, I said, you know, baby, our kid and Chris is going to have to take, go to school on the bus. And a look of horror went over my wife's face. And I said, but, we'll give him a phone so we can be safe and be in touch with you. And she said, yeah, tonight. We're going out tonight. And we go out and get him the dumb phone, you know, that didn't really do anything. And of course, about a year later, it got damaged or whatever, and we had to replace it. And I remember going into the store and the guy being all excited saying, oh, we got this phone. He can do this, this, and this. And I go, I don't want that. I don't want him to have access to the internet. And the response was, you don't have a choice. We don't have the dumb phones anymore. We just have these things that give your kids access to everything and give the world access to your kid.
pretty nifty little trick there from the industry, isn't it?
That's not the word I would use, but...
Yeah, I mean, look, I have a healthy dose of Australian humour and cynicism when it comes to this stuff, because I, for many years, have been talking about the fact that the tech industries give us parental controls on these phones, and they say, look, don't worry about it, Jed. You know, we've got these amazing parental controls. And what I said to the Australian Parliament last year in giving testimony is, even if we choose not to ban social media, which of course we did and I supported, even if we don't, the least we can do is make the tech companies give us parental controls that actually work, because mm-hmm. they don't. Mm-hmm. At the moment, every parent will tell you that it is so easy to get around parental controls for any child. It is laughable.
Uh-huh.
And that is the signs of an industry that continues to regulate themselves. Mm-hmm. And that is problematic. We've seen that time and time again for many emerging industries. When you are left to regulate yourself, you will inevitably choose profit over well-being.
Yeah.
And you only have to look at the litany of tech company bosses who do not give their own kids access to these phones or this technology. And mm-hmm. that tells you everything you need to know.
Yeah. So let's get into do not disturb, or how to say no to your phone and the rest of the world. What are kids going to learn, and what are parents going to learn, hopefully, when they read this book or co-read this book with their kids?
Yeah, I think co-read is a really good way to approach this topic. So as I mentioned before, my first book, The Tech Diet for Your Child and Teen, is a parent-focused book. It is very much for parents. But that came out in 2019. And of course, what followed was many parents saying, listen, Brad, can I read this with my child? The answer is yes, you can, but there's a lot of stuff in there that's probably not great to share with them, including the strategies of how you should try to put boundaries around this in a healthy way. And so the answer was then Magic Cat out of London reached out to me and asked me and commissioned me to write this, you know, teens and tweens book, essentially, that could be co-read by a family member. And so I got together with a colleague, Lindsay Hassick, who's the co-author here, fantastic psychologist in this space as well. And we'd set out to write a very simple version of some of the concepts that were in Tech Diet, but really for the young adults, the teens and tweens reader. Now, what they will expect is similar things to what I find work when I'm giving talks. I do seminars and whatnot at schools and conferences. And really the approach here, Jed, is to try to educate teens and tweens about the persuasive design elements of our phones and how that can suck you in. And I know these days that sounds like a very common thing because we're all talking about it, but you've got to remember, you know, I wrote this about 2 years ago. And so that was something that wasn't really talked about 2 years ago. And really it's about education. So, you know, when I'm giving school talks, it's amazing when you speak to these sort of 8, 10, 12-year-olds, you run through all of the different elements of persuasive design behind their phone, social media, gaming, and the areas that keep this phone sticky is the term that that Silicon Valley used, but addictive, it's essentially. So you're educating them on the strategies that the companies are using to keep them on their phone longer than they intend. And that's what we go through with this book. And then we talk a lot about the areas of life that are impacted, so sleep, exercise, face-to-face relationships, and it really is designed to be that co-read. I'm not under any illusions that every single 12 or 14-year-old wants to read this book and is mm-hmm. going to buy it themselves. This is really a book that is for a grandparent, an aunt, an uncle, a godparent, or a parent to say, hey, listen, you're about to get your first phone at age 14 or 16, whatever age it is. Let's just read through this together first so we can both understand what some of the trappings are and what we have to look out for.
Yeah. Boy, you know, if there was a government that was coming into our kids' lives and saying, here, here's a device, and it's going to do everything it can to get you addicted to, and just for us to keep your attention and for us to play with your mind, I think parents would be up in arms. But we don't seem to be worried about it when it's a for-profit company.
Yeah, look, that's a really interesting sort of pinch me moment here as well, because I have kids myself.
Mm-hmm.
They don't have phones. I am the uncool dad,
mm-hmm.
Essentially. And it's a really tricky one for me, because I try not to let my work and my public profile get in the way of or negatively impact my kids. Essentially, I don't want them, you know, their friends to be saying, you know, your dad's that guy that made all our parents stop giving us phones or put parameters around screen times. But that has been my modus operandi for the last 13 years, try to go under the radar, essentially. So what that means is I don't tell, you know, most people what I do. That changed a year ago. Mm. A year ago, when I was raising public awareness for the Australian government push, I started to have this really weird scenario where parents were actually coming up to me in different areas. Not that I knew. I was coaching my son's soccer team, and a random parent from another soccer team came up and had seen me on TV and thanked me for my work. And it was weird for me, because it was this shift. It marked this shift in public sentiment that was palpable in Australia. Parents were starting to realize that this is not okay, and we cannot let the tech companies do this unchecked. And this is not okay to be targeting children with this. An adult has the right to make a decision, just like smoking cigarettes or drinking alcohol or any of these other things that have, you know, potentially negative impacts. Mm-hmm. They have the right to make that decision. But mm-hmm. a child doesn't get that right in this. They are being coerced. Mm-hmm. So to your point then, and I'm sorry, it was a bit of a long-winded way here, sentiment has changed in Australia, and I do believe it is going to change in countries like America as well. And, you know, that is being pushed along by books like The Anxious Generation by Jonathan Haidt there that came out about a year ago, which has very similar concepts to what the tech diet did. But, of course, he's a very sort of famous professor, so I think it went a little bit further. But it's also just because the timing of Jonathan's book was excellent. The public were ready to hear it. Whereas when I wrote about this stuff in 2019, I think most parents were just like, oh, that's that guy that says this is doing damage and he's just an alarmist and he needs to relax. It's all just technology. It's no different to when the printing press came or the radio came. It is very different. It is targeted algorithms here. This is not a passive technology. And I think public sentiment and education is starting to awaken to that around the world.
Yeah, I really hope so. Curious, I was talking to somebody earlier today talking about, and they have a wonderful program called Dude Be Nice, and they just celebrate people being nice to each other. And I said to them, wouldn't it be cool if our kids were watching your videos and our adults were watching your videos, so we can train our algorithm to start sending us nice videos, videos that uplift us. Would it? I'm guessing you're going to say, don't let your kids be on Instagram. But is there a way that we can help our kids train their? No, never mind. It's a dumb idea. Stop with the social media.
No, I mean, I think that we should be open to having those sorts of nuanced conversations, Jed. Mm-hmm. Right? I mean, it's not helpful for someone like me or someone on the other side to just shut things down. You know, really what you're talking about is something that has been raised before around creating safer technology by design, which essentially is pushing the social media companies, including YouTube and things like that, to make their platforms by design more safe, mm-hmm. And not have algorithms that show us shock horror things and all the rest of it. And there are things that they could do. The problem is that is a tricky thing that they're not going to do voluntarily. Okay, so if I can try and come up with a crass analogy here, quite often we liken this stuff to a physical health diet, meaning like the food that a child digests. A small amount of sometimes foods, as they call it here in Australia, maybe it's the same there, you know, chocolate or French fries or ice cream or any of these things, a small amount is fine.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. The problem is that all of those foods become, you know, fire up different areas in your brain pathways, dopamine, etc. And so you are going to crave more. And when you are young, you have a underdeveloped prefrontal cortex, which is the area of the brain that is responsible for impulse control and emotional control. It is the handbrake that your brain has to say, no, I'm going to stop eating that ice cream. And so it would kind of like be asking us to say to the candy manufacturers, can you make your candy less sweet and less tasty and all these things? Are they going to do that? Probably not, because really it ruins their business model. Their business model is based on people consuming that. And this is similar for technology as well. So if it's something we could convince technology to do with us, that would be great, but you'd have to do it across the board, because you're not going to have one social media platform, for example, or messaging platform say, yes, I'm going to be a good ethical citizen and do that, when all the others don't, because the one that does is probably going to ruin their business model and they'll go out of business. Right. It's a really complicated situation that we've created here.
Yeah. Well, we know it's possible because I understand Chinese TikTok is very different than the TikTok our kids experience here in the States and in Australia. I understand that Chinese TikTok is pretty positive and shows educational stuff and stuff.
Yeah, absolutely. There is somewhat an addictive quality to that, but it's nowhere near as addictive as sending you all these things that enrage you. Mm-hmm. And make you angry at the other side, whatever that other side is, right? Whether it be political or ideologically or whatever it is. And you're right. But I guess then we get into this territory of, do we have governance oversight that is to the levels of, a communist government?
Right.
I personally don't think that's a good idea either. So it's a really tricky, and I don't claim to have all the solutions. All I know is that as parents, we need to be aware and educate our kids on what this technology is doing and why it's drawing them in and how that's impacting them.
Yeah. Let's tell everybody where they can go to find out more about Do Not Disturb and also maybe find out more about your screens and gaming disorder clinic.
Yeah, pleasure. So anyone who wants to just type in Google unplugged psychologist, or you can just type in Dr. Brad Marshall, and you should find my clinic, more about my books, media stuff, everything that you can sort of possibly want there. Ironically, I am on social media as well, Jed, reluctantly. And so Instagram and Facebook for parents, because that's where we get information. I'll be completely honest, I don't actually physically post anything there. I have someone that does that for me because I don't like to open those apps for obvious reasons. But you will at least get me and my content on there if you're looking for more information. And then as far as where to get the books, I mean, every good bookstore, and I believe on Amazon and those sorts of places as well, you can jump online and get your copy of Do Not Disturb for any parent that is concerned about their child or teenager's phone use, or even before you give them a phone, whatever phone that is. This is a great co-read for you to be able to educate them and warn them. And it will also allow you to then bring up, if their phone use does become a little bit problematic or unhealthy, you have a base point of, hey, remember when we looked through that book and we talked about impact on sleep or face-to-face or schoolwork? Do you think any of that's happening? So it's a great conversation starter and a good baseline level there for any parent or adult worried about their child getting a phone.
We've had a really powerful conversation with the author of the new middle grade novel. It's called Do Not Disturb. Our guest has been Dr. Brad Marshall. Dr. Brad, thanks so much for being on Reading With Your Kids.
It's been awesome, Jed. Thank you.
This episode of Reading With Your Kids is brought to you by Princess Naomi Helps a Unicorn, a dance it out creative movement story for young movers. Unicorns and horses and snakes. Oh, my! Interactive movement wrapped up in a charming story of sibling angst, anger management, compassion, and triumph. Fed up with her annoying sister, Naomi storms out of the castle, only to discover a unicorn in need of help. With a sense of purpose, she quickly forgets her anger. Princess Naomi is just one of the many wonderful books you can find at onceuponadance.com. Mother and daughter duo with a passion for dance and storytelling. They strive to share joyful movement, honor the beauty and discipline of ballet, and foster freedom of expression. Check it out today, onceuponadance.com. This episode of Reading With Your Kids is brought to you by Trumpet, the Miracle Wolf Pup Series. There's a brand new book in the series, and we're so excited to tell you all about it. Trumpet Becomes a Mom. In this exciting book, Trumpet and Lighthawk, now a bonded pair, start their own family with their very first litter of pups. Families can read together, schools can explore the importance of wolf packs and conservation, and Trumpet fans everywhere can celebrate this milestone in her incredible journey. Grab your copy today, available on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, select bookstores, and the Wolf Conservation Center, where Trumpet and her family live. Plus, 50% of all profits go right back to supporting the Wolf Conservation Center, with more donated to Lighthawk Conservation Flying. So grab your book today and have a group haul for Trumpet and her family. Join us right now from the great state of Kansas, where I was told they went from summer right into winter. That's not fun at all. Please welcome to the show the author of Dash and the Lights in the Sky, Ashley Key. Hey, Ashley, how are you?
I'm good, Jed. How are you doing today?
I'm really wonderful. This sounds like a fun book. Tell us all about it.
Yeah, sure. Absolutely. So I wrote a book to hopefully get parents and students and children to learn a little bit together about the Northern Lights. I think most people don't understand or know the science behind the Northern Lights and why they appear and when they appear, even where they can appear. Believe it or not, they've been seen in Kansas before due to solar storms. And so my hope was to write a children's book so that parents and kids could read together and learn more as a family.
That is awesome. I had the pleasure of seeing the Northern Lights once around midnight in Vermont while we're up skiing. And we didn't get the crazy colors that you see in the Arctic or in Iceland. But it was absolutely amazing.
It is. It is a breathtaking sight. And believe it or not, sometimes they can even be black, white, or gray. They're not always these gorgeous colors that we constantly see. However, green is the more common color. I had the pleasure of seeing them when I was in Iceland, and actually right outside my Airbnb, there was just this gorgeous ribbon of light that it almost looked like you could touch it. It was so close. It was so phenomenal. And here in Kansas, we don't quite get those sights. But on occasion, due to a solar storm, we can get a little glimpse of the beautiful Aurora Borealis.
Yeah. So let's talk about the Northern Lights. This isn't caused by a group of nerdy guys with drones flying around in the air.
It is not. Believe it or not, it's caused by the sun and also the gases that we have in our atmosphere at the time. That's why I was saying earlier that green is the most common color. So green is what you will see most, with red being the most uncommon color. And red is seen way higher in the atmosphere, but all of it is caused by particles sent down by the sun.
What kind of part? And I understand that the sun has these bursts every once in a while, and they send down the light rays. But what kind of particles are they sending down that causes the Northern Lights?
So it is it's a bunch of storms mostly, but it's just sending down a bunch of different particles that happen due to solar combustions. And whenever they hit certain gases in our atmosphere, it changes the different colors. Now, the reason why we can see it in certain areas versus others is these specific particles are attracted to each of our poles, our magnetic poles, both the north and the south. So up north, they're actually called Aurora Borealis, but down south, they're Aurora Australis. So those are the two different sisters of lights that can be seen.
Wow. I did not know that it was around the southern poles, too. That's really neat. And it makes a lot of sense. I just never thought about it.
Yeah, so it's not something that just happens up north, although that's what we constantly hear, but it's something that can happen down south too. And that's due to the fact that, you know, you're asking what type of particles, it's just charged particles. And so it's kind of like when you play with magnets and you've got some metal shavings and you'll see them be attracted both to the northern pole and the southern pole. So they do happen quite often down on the southern pole as well, but we just don't hear too much about it.
Now, you are very knowledgeable when it comes to, did you just gain this knowledge researching Dash in the lights in the sky, or are you a secret scientist?
So I actually have a very unique background. I used to be a technical and contract writer, actually, for the federal government, and I wrote for satellite communications. A page in my book also discusses it, but the curvature of the Earth and the polar regions can really disrupt satellite communications. Fun fact, the northern lights very much disrupt satellite communications. So it's something that I found out pretty early on in my career whenever I was trying to install Wi-Fi and remote Alaskan northern bases. And so it inspired me to write this book because it is something that I have a background in and something that I feel like I could have shared with my own two daughters and teach them in a fun way that is also conducive to a child.
Yeah. So tell us about the characters we're going to meet in the book.
Yeah, so there are three main characters. I've got Dash the Husky, and he's actually inspired by my real-life husky, Drake, who himself has seen the northern lights. He's also my travel buddy. He's been all over, including Europe. And he was obsessed and very curious as to what the northern lights were, trying to run around and catch them in his mouth. It also included is Nimbus, who is an Arctic fox. In this current book, because it is the middle of winter, Nimbus is all white. However, I will have a sequel coming out where Nimbus will be tan, because Arctic foxes are not always white. They're usually white in the dead of winter, but whenever they get into those warmer months, their fur changes with the surroundings, so that way they're less likely to be prey. But Nimbus is all white in this book, and I was inspired by an Arctic fox I actually saw when I saw the northern lights, and I thought she looked like a puffy cloud, which is where the name Nimbus comes from. In addition, the final and third character is a wise owl, Echo, who actually leads Dash and Nimbus through the journey of explaining what the northern lights are, kind of falling back on that wise old owl stereotype. And she is a snowy owl, so again, all white. And those are the three characters in this book.
Very cool. It must have been quite a difference going from writing technical papers about satellite communication to writing a kid's book.
Yes, absolutely. But my girls have definitely kind of led the way and shown what piques and captures children's interest, and kind of a meeting of the minds, if you will, and a way to explain some of the harder scientific concepts in a way that my girls will understand. It's fun. Yeah. I definitely wrote it with them as well.
Excellent. Excellent. I love it. Now that Dash and the Lights is out in the world, are you planning to write more children's books?
I am. I actually am hoping to write more about the Arctic and what I learned researching all of there, including even though it didn't have anything to do with satellite communications while I was up there. I really enjoyed the local animals and finding out about them, seeing the tracks in the snow. So hopefully that'll be my next book, is learning about tracks in the snow and how fur changes to meet the surroundings up in the Arctic.
Well, you know, I was going to ask you that. I'm glad you brought it up. I've always been amazed that chameleons are able to change their color, and it's even more amazing that the fur of the Arctic fox changes color. It's not like they can go to a salon and get a dye job.
Correct. It is all actually kind of just in their their instincts, and it changes due to the weather. And there's more than just the foxes. You have the Arctic hare, the beautiful bunnies up there with the long ears. They're pure white during the Arctic months as well, but turn into a tannish color during the summer, spring, and fall periods. And it's just, it's marvelous to see how many animals up there do change. When we hear about animals changing color, it normally is the chameleon. And so I was so fascinated when I would travel up north and find out about how many animals coat change just to blend in with the snow.
Yeah, that's really wild. It sounds like between your work in satellite communications and your interest in the Northern Lights and Arctic animals, it sounds like you have a real strong interest in the STEM fields.
Yes, I absolutely do. I've always had an interest in the STEM field, even as a child. Science and nature were my absolute favorite subjects. Another thing that happened in my life that encouraged me to write a children's book, I actually volunteer biweekly out here at my Great Plains Nature Center, teaching kids 5 and under all about Kansas nature, the animals we have out here, what our environment is. And I was really looking for some more books to share with the kiddos because I've loved to watch their love for science just absolutely grow. Their vocabulary is so amazing after it. I just did a series on bats, and there was a 3-year-old that walked out with her hands in a hook saying, "Bats hang upside down." And just watching them get those fun little facts out of nature and see that science isn't just in a textbook, on a TV series, at the Science Center, it's all around us, is something I really take joy out of.
Oh, maybe you can answer a question. We live in the city of Boston, but we're as far away from downtown as you can be and still be within the city. And we have a wildlife sanctuary borders my property. And so we have all sorts of, in fact, tonight when I got home, twice a year, our backyard becomes a rest area for birds that are migrating either north or south. And today they were there. This was the day. And, but we also have, a great number of bats that fly around in the evening, and it's great. They take care of the mosquitoes and the bugs. But I'm wondering, I don't see them. I don't go out in the winter all that much at night. Are they around in the wintertime, or do they take off to warmer climes?
Certain bats are absolutely around in the wintertime, but there are so many different species of bats. We have bats. There's a bat called a bumblebee bat that is literally the size of a bumblebee. It is so tiny and so minuscule. And then in India, we have a bat that is 4 feet tall called a flying fox because it looks more like a fox than a bat. So it depends on the species of bat, but in the Midwest, there are many species that actually do stay around in the wintertime and don't migrate down south to warmer weather. And so you might see them out and about, but for the most part, they stick to their roosts, which okay. is actually their nest, per se. Right. That's what you would call their nest.
Very cool. Well, we should tell people where they can go to find out more about Dash and the Lights in the Sky and find out more about you.
Yeah, absolutely. So Dash and the Lights in the Sky is going to be available on BarnesandNoble.com. I'm very excited about that. It was absolutely a dream to get into my favorite bookstore ever. In addition, it'll be available on Amazon. And in the book, I've got a little bio. I've also got a picture of my real-life husky and a little bio on him as well. Included in the hardcover and softcover, I actually go into further science, about 8 to 9 pages, explaining a little bit more in depth, more about the Aurora Borealis, and even the different planets you can see it on, because Earth is not the only planet that gets Aurora Borealis, including crafts as well and things that you can try at home, connected with next generation science standards. So hopefully we can all raise the next generation of scientists.
Awesome. Awesome. And you said that the book will be available. When is it coming out?
It is coming out December 1st, right around the time when people can start seeing the Northern Lights.
Excellent. We've had a really fun time. talking about Dash and the Lights in the Sky. It's a brand new picture book from our guest, Ashley Key. Hey, Ashley, thanks for being on Reading with Your Kids.
Thanks, Dad. I hope you have a wonderful day.
Before we invite our guest into the studio, I would love to invite you to visit a very special website. It's clownswithoutborders.org. clownswithoutborders.org. This is a group that I absolutely adore. I am part of Clowns Without Borders, and I had the honor of being part of the 2023 tour of El Salvador. I had so much fun joining with artists from all over the world to bring a smile to people who really needed it and really appreciated it too. And we would love for you to join us as a monthly Joymaker. The Joymakers, they're a family of people just like you who love to laugh and make other people feel good. So please take a moment and visit clownswithoutborders.org and consider joining me as a Joymaker. And now here's a quick listen back to our conversation with Dr. Sylvia Earle. Just speaking with you for this little bit of time so far, you have a passion and a love for the ocean. What has sparked that?
When I was just 3 years old, I got knocked over by a wave. My parents were taking the family to the beach. And at first it was scary, but then I realized that was fun. And I think my mom saw that big smile on my face, and she let me jump back in, and I've been jumping back in ever since. But it was not just the exhilaration of feeling the energy of the ocean. It was life. The ocean is full of life. There's the impression when you look from the shore that it's a lot of water, which it is, a lot of salty water, which it is, but every spoonful is filled with something. The tiny creatures that are important for the larger creatures, right up to the biggest animals on Earth, whales, especially the great blue whale, which is the largest animal that's ever lived, and bigger than dinosaurs, mm-hmm, by quite a lot. So knowing how amazing that abundance and diversity of life in the ocean has just kept me focused for all my life.
Now, you mentioned that, you know, on the surface, we see a lot of water. And if you're out in the middle of the ocean, you're seeing a lot of water and not much else for miles and miles and miles. But there's so much more going on beneath the surface of the ocean. And you've spent a lot of time down there. I understand you've actually spent time living underwater. What's that like?
Well, I have thousands of hours as a scuba diver, but more using little submersibles, more than 30 different kinds of submersibles. I mean, it's like saying I've used more than 30 different kinds of cars to get around. But more than that, little submarines can take you where cars cannot go and come back and keep you safe. And living underwater, I've done that now 10 times. The first time was just such a revelation for me because I got to see fish as individuals. I had seen them before, and anybody can do this, you know, diving, even snorkeling. But to spend enough time with them in one place. I remember Jane Goodall, mm-hmm, spent years living in the forest in Gombe in Africa. Got to know individual chimpanzees. It was really the first time anyone had spent enough time to really recognize their individual behaviors, their faces. Well, fish have faces too. But normally we don't have the opportunity to recognize that. And not only their faces, but they have different behaviors, different attitudes. Some are shy, some are more inquisitive, and just like kids. Some are really, you know, out there running around looking at everything they can see. Others kind of sit back and watch. And that's true with fish, too. It was just a transformational experience for me the first time, and it's been reinforced every other time. even with the short visits I have using scuba.
Wow, that's fascinating. Do you remember the first fish that you got to know? That sounds like such a silly question, but I'm listening to you, and you're telling us that the fish have these individual personalities and and behaviors. Do you remember that first fish that you met?
Well, it was actually a group of five angelfish. They're such curious, gentle-looking, well, actually behaving creatures. I would get up really early in the morning, like right now here in San Francisco, I'm up really early. And just as dawn was breaking, and from different parts of the reef, these five angelfish would get together and swim around. They spent the day together. And at night, at dusk, they'd go their separate ways, tuck in, go to sleep, and then get up in the morning. So I looked for them every morning and really enjoyed dawn because there they were, like pals. And they were young angelfish. As adults, they pair up. And we think of, generally don't think of a fish as having, mates that stick together. If you see fish in a restaurant or in a supermarket or even in an aquarium, you don't tend to see the kind of behavior you do out in the big aquarium, the ocean itself, where these alliances, these, I almost want to say friendships, but they're whatever it is, they stick together. And sometimes, curiously, it isn't just with members of the same species. I've seen personally, and others now have recorded, instances where a grouper and a moray eel will go fishing together. I mean, fish go fishing. But a grouper, this is usually led by the grouper. The grouper finds a place where he thinks a fish that he'd like to munch on might be living. And he goes over to his friend, quotes, his fishing partner, a moray eel, and gives a signal. And the moray comes out of his lair and joins the grouper for a fishing expedition. And, an eel is long and slender as compared to a grouper. It tends to be chunky and too big to go down in the places that eels can go. Mm-hmm. So however it is that the grouper can sense where lunch might be, he stands over that, hangs over that place, and the eel dives in and gets to where the grouper can't go, emerges with lunch, and then they both dine together. It's just amazing. Who would think that that fish can plan and have team up with a member, well, not only of their own vertebrate fish allies, but grouper also team up sometimes with an octopus.
Wow.
Similarly, they go fishing together, and an octopus is really good at getting down into the crevices in a reef and can, unlike the grouper that can't navigate in those tight spaces, the grouper and the octopus team up as fishing buddies. It's just amazing. It's the gift of time, being able to spend enough time in the ocean to see these relationships. And far beyond that, it's understanding how all of the ocean, and really all of the living world, is connected with behaviors, with food chains, with the chemistry of life that affects the chemistry of the air, chemistry of the water itself.
We are so grateful that you got to spend part of your day with us here at Reading With Your Kids. Hey, if this episode made you smile or gave you something to think about, please pass it on. And I expect to see lots of people sharing this link, because between Dr. Brad Marshall talking about Do Not Disturb, Ashley Key talking about the Northern Lights, Dr. Sylvia Earle talking about the amazing things in our oceans, that didn't make you give you something to think about. You weren't listening. My goodness, this is incredible. Please share the link. Leave us a 5-star review and hit that subscribe button. And listen, if you'd like to listen to all of Dr. Earle's episode, you can find that on our website. Go to readingwithyourkids.com. There's a little button there that says listen to all our episodes, and then you'll be able to find a search bar. Type in November 20th, 2021, or Dr. Sylvia Earle, and that episode will pop up. If you haven't already, just check out all of readingwithyourkids.com. You can visit our Certified Great Reading Wall of Fame. If you're an author, you can find out how you can be a guest, and you can check out our blog. I want to thank the folks who made today's show so wonderful, starting, of course, with our guest, Dr. Brad Marshall. Please be sure to check out Do Not Disturb. Ashley Key, please be sure to check out Dash and the Lights in the Sky. Dr. Sylvia Earle, I want to thank my team, Fatima Khan, Chris Doherty. I want to thank my beautiful wife, for all the love and support she gives me. Most of all, we want to thank you. You're helping to shape a kinder, smarter world, and you're doing that every time you read with your kids. I'll be looking for you in the next episode of Reading with Your Kids.